It's the International Clearance Podcast. Welcome to another week. It's episode 17 or episode 7 of this second series. I'm Joe Walker, one of your two hosts. And alongside me, as always, is Scully. How are you doing over there?
Doing very well, actually. I'm feeling fantastic.
Good man. I tempted fate the last time we were on. Did that super long, I kept saying pervy. Nerdy was probably more accurate, but like a comprehensive European roundup that took up the whole episode. We did mention in that Arsenal had Porto. Danny Loader did not come on for Porto, but he didn't need to, and we don't need to say any more than that. I feel like we should kick off the show with the second leg stuff since we've last been on. It will be quicker, I promise you, listener, don't worry. There were some more Champions League games since we've last been on, but only one of note other than what I just said is PSV 1, Dortmund 1. Jadon Sancho's played 68 minutes. I feel like Sancho coming back made that impact in his first game, I think, with an assist. Haven't heard much noise since then. That's not a mark against him, but the level he has to be to keep getting these video clips and talk about, oh, should he be back in the England squad? The bar is now so high because of what he did the first time he was there, right? It's tempting from this format and this podcast to look for that and think, is he not doing that well if he hasn't got that? But ultimately, I guess the whole move was about just getting back playing football again and enjoying football again.
Yeah, I think he's going to be under a specific microscope. The best thing that could happen for him is for us to ignore him and he just plays football. But that's obviously not going to happen. So he, unfortunately, has to perform. So he wasn't great in the Champions League game. And he wasn't great last week. But it's still early days. Early enough days, at least.
Yeah, it's interesting that point you make there. The best thing we can do is just look the other way and just let him get on with it. But it's easier said than done in the professional game anyway.
And also the complete antithesis of this show. So
yes, quite.
Exactly. We will be watching.
Yeah. There are more Champions League games in like 2 weeks' time or so, 10 days by the time this comes out, for all those second legs. But the Europa League, those and the Conference League had those second legs of the knockout playoff for some of those teams that were trying to get into the round of 16, meeting people that have dropped down from the other competitions. Rennes beat Milan 3-2. But if you remember, Loftus Cheek scored 2 for Milan in the first leg. They've gone through on aggregate anyway. They didn't start Loftus Cheek. He only came on for the last half hour once it got a little bit nervy. But Milan are through. They'll play Slavia Prague. I would imagine they'll get past them. Looking like a strong contenders, actually, to go all the way in the Europa League anyway. Tomori injured, by the way. I feel like we didn't mention him last time either, but that's why he's not been mentioned. Sporting drew 1-1 with Young Boys, so go through 4-2 on aggregate. Another 90 minutes for Marcus Edwards, not necessarily any assists in that, but look, he's one of their stronger players. Sporting, in the next round, will play Atalanta. So you're going to have Marcus Edwards v Adamola Lookman there.
That's North London versus South London, no? We've got a nice little London derby going on there.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Sparta Prague, one of the big surprises of the night, beat Galatasaray 4-1 to go through 6-4 on aggregate. That's Wilfried Zaha's European adventure over for this season. He comes on about an hour. Sparta Prague are like 5-4 up on aggregate, I believe. And there's a late goal where they get one on the break in injury time because Galatasaray are like pushing for that equaliser. And Zaha's involved in losing the ball for one of those goals. It happens, whatever. I think the sickener is that Sparta Prague are now been drawn in the next round with Liverpool. You know, Galatasaray would have not gone through, but given how much he had the appetite for the Man United fixture in a Champions League, I think he would have enjoyed going to Anfield again and making an impact. But not this season. Not this season, Wilfried. It was still worth it for him to go and experience European football, right? Let's say this is one and done, which I'm not sure it will. But we'll see. Was that enough for him? Do you reckon that would be enough to be like, I did it. I played in the Champions League. I scored in the Champions League. We dumped out the Europa League almost immediately.
I'm going to answer this as somebody who's not a Palace fan, but is also a Wolves fan. I think he can do more. Yes, he plays in Turkey now, but I honestly don't see why he can't go to perhaps a slower league like Serie A or Bundesliga with the high lines. It was definitely probably fruitful for him. Nice to experience something crazy like that. But I think he can aim for another year or two abroad. And if I'm him, I'm doing that.
Yeah, he's still doing pretty well in the league. But I mean, both of those, Europa League playoff games, he was on the bench for Galatasaray and came on. They are currently first in the league, 2 points clear at the time of recording. So, I mean, if he wins the title there, he'll be more than happy regardless. So we'll see how that works out.
Title, 100%.
Another one from the Europa League for in terms of the round of 16. Marseille 3, Shakhtar 1, they go through. We mentioned Emre Nsoglu, the 18-year-old, born in France, raised in England, and is now at Marseille. He came on in that game right at the end. Again, a name you might hear a lot more of in the future. They'll play Villarreal. Thought I'd mention as well, also in that draw for the round of 16, Leverkusen will be playing Karabag. I'd be stunned if Leverkusen don't get past them, and Nathan Teller having a little bit of a good time.
If they don't get past them there, that'll be very, very interesting.
Yeah, but it'll be surely be repackaged. Like you lot, Arsenal last season, when Sporting done you, you're like, oh yeah, didn't care. We're pushing for the league. Yeah, don't worry. We just focus on the league now.
It was I want to say we did care. Like, we did want to focus on the league, but we did care.
It was just this immediate kind of protective easing of the disappointment. Conference League, same stage, knockout round playoff, winners go into round of 16. Ajax, Jesus Christ. Ajax make it through in the very late in extra time at Bodo Glimt in sort of north of Norway, deep in the snow and the cold. Jordan Henderson not in the squad. Going there without him by choice seems mad. So I'm assuming he's injured. They won 2-1 away there. Chuba Akpom did play. He started the first leg. He was on the bench for this one. And the guy that normally plays up front, that Brobby, scored, I think, or at least set up one. He then got injured just for half time. So Chuba Akpom played over a half, didn't score. You know, that thing we keep saying, All we can do is make the difference when he is called upon, because the guy in front of him is doing so well. You need to score in a game like that. They get through anyway. Right. These are the moments.
Yeah, you have to grab opportunity with both hands.
Yeah. But, you know, depend on how Brobby is. He may have to, Akpom may start again this weekend for Ajax. The week after that, Ajax have been drawn in a round of 16 with Aston Villa. I imagine Villa, particularly in the state Ajax are in, will see off Ajax. But, because I mean, Brighton saw off Ajax.
I don't want to say it. Let's be real.
Elsewhere in the Conference League, in terms of like our representation, Union Saint-Gilloise, I think it said, or Union SG of Belgium, we've spoken about them before. In the domestic league, they're currently 8 points clear in the Belgian league. They haven't won a league in 90 years, and they're like very on track for that. Only got promoted two, three years ago. They won away at Eintracht Frankfurt. I think they drew the home leg and won 2-1 away at Eintracht Frankfurt to go 3-3, 4-3 on aggregate. Christian Burgess, captain, ex-Portsmouth, played the full 90 again. And Ross Sykes, who we mentioned last week, again, comes on as a late sub to close the game. They play Fenerbahce in the next round. There's a round of 16 for 2 years running. It's quite something. But, you know, another little international clearance derby, because, of course, Fenerbahce have Ryan Kent, former Liverpool Rangers. Plenty of British representation overseas in these later rounds of the European competition. I love it.
Big up Ryan Kent, man. I was watching him bat it up at Rangers and I was thinking, what team is he going to go to next? Like, who is going to make the punt on him? I was surprised it was Fenerbahce, but I hope he's doing well over there and he's enjoying it.
I want to shout you, Scully. Last time we did this, we spoke about Sturm Graz beating Slovan Bratislava. I picked out Max Johnston, who'd played for Motherwell. You clocked someone I hadn't in terms of Mika Birif, who from London, Danish under 21 international on loan from Arsenal. Well, he scored again in his second leg, the only goal. Sturm Graz are 4 on that first leg, but scored in both legs. 4 goals in 6 games for Sturm Graz since joining on loan in January. Well, he's not going to be at Sturm Graz in the summer, is he?
He absolutely will not. I actually have a feeling we will probably try and integrate him next season, but I'd be happy for him to go out on loan, because no disrespect to Sturm Graz once again, but like, the difference between Sturm Graz and Arsenal is massive. If he can get to like somewhere where the level is a little bit higher and he can play regularly and we can see what he's really about, because obviously he was amazing on Motherwell with Max Johnston, doing quite well at Sturm Graz for Loney. We just need to check out what his real level is, because it's looking scary right now.
Yeah. Ultimately, whether or not he's going to be good enough for Arsenal, when you go on these loan spells, you're supposed to absolutely smash it. That's like the minimum expected for Arsenal to be like, okay, let's have another conversation. All you can do is go crazy. They didn't include any kind of buy option in this loan spell. Even Standard reported that Stone Gratz want to make it permanent in the summer, but they're not very confident of it. But yeah, I mean, fair play to him. That's hell of an impact, still only 21. And yeah, at worst, there's a championship loan for him in the pipeline if he wants to do that. Or given that he's a Danish under 21 international now, maybe he wants to pivot to play for Copenhagen or someone like that.
Yeah, I'm certain he's not going to be short of offers this summer. If he wants to go, he's gonna go to a decent enough team. And if he wants to stay, I think they would have a plan for him. Obviously, 21 years, it's the kind of make or break age when it comes to academy football and all of this. So, yeah, let's see what happens.
Yeah. Sturm Graz in the next round will play Lille, who, of course, have former Manchester United midfielder, England 21 midfielder, Angel Gomez. So, in national clearance derbies, there's a few here already in this Conference League, especially. We spoke a lot about Archie Brown last week at Ghent. He played 90 minutes for them, but they lost. Well, they lost on aggregate. They drew the home leg, which wasn't enough to go through. So he won't be in the round of 16. And there, I said it'd be quicker. It wasn't that much quicker, but that's a quicker roundup of the European stuff. And I want to get into some stuff in Germany, seeing as we're not. There's always something to say in Germany. Do you remember your jingle?
No. That's a new one.
It wasn't far away from that, to be honest. Two more goals for Harry Kane. They beat Leipzig 2-1, which, given the state of them in the last week, 2 weeks, that's a big, big result. Tuchel is now leaving at the end of the season. They obviously can't afford to like write it off just yet, so he leaves it in the summer. There's some really weird interviews. But Kane's just, all Kane can do is just carry on scoring goals. 27 in 23 league games.
He won this match in the last minute.
Yeah.
It was a very important win. That loss to Leverkusen has upset the title race. They're chasing massively. Yep. You never put anything beyond Bayern. Like I said, I don't care what is happening in the Bundesliga until late April. But it is in disrepute. And I think with Tuchel leaving and with all of the, you know, allegations, the media looking in, all of this, they might actually lose this, which doesn't bear well for Kane's mate, Dyer.
There were some talks and reports around Eric Dyer that they weren't looking to extend his loan. These are like German reports out of Germany. I couldn't really verify whether it was just whispers or what. But there was already concerns at his lack of pace, and they definitely weren't looking to keep him on beyond this loan. And I thought, if that was the issue, did you not ever scout Eric Dyer prior?
It is a massive indictment to Eric Dyer to go to the Bundesliga and they tell you, hold on, you look slow. It's gone.
The injury time winner from Kane, the long ball from defence comes from Eric Dyer, because we mentioned last week, Upamecano suspended, sent off in the league and sent off in the Champions League. So the second leg, Eric Dyer might play centre-back in the second leg against Lazio in the Champions League, but he played 90 minutes as centre-back in this game, which I thought was interesting because on the bench is Kim Min-jae. So he came on in the game, but he played in midfield. I know he's a little bit versatile, but surely you'd be prioritising playing him unless you wanted him in midfield more than Eric Dyer. I don't know. Tuchel has his ways, but Dyer played 90 minutes and yeah, it's his kind of quote-unquote, the kids say, pre-assist for the winner.
I think realistically, they wanted Dyer to play with Premier League PMP. PMP is the focus of the Premier League. For listeners who don't know what that is, that's pace and power. Like, you look at your Van Dijk's, your Kanates, your Salibas, your Gabriels. That's what they want in centre-back. Powerful, strong, good enough pass of the ball. I don't think there's an issue with having a slower centre-back that has a great reading in the game. And I'm guessing they kind of wanted Dyer to do a similar job in terms of, like, read the game, add some calm to the back line, only play sparingly when we need you, not every week. Obviously, injuries have meant he's had to play more. But his physical limitations are probably much greater than they imagined. Alongside Kim Min-jae, who's not settling after moving from Syria. And then Upamecano, who hasn't been the same since that World Cup. It's a bit spooky for Bayern, actually. I think Kane watch is going to get a lot more sadder as time goes on.
As he keeps doing great things, but knowing it's all just for nothing, really. He's had a golden boot.
We are going to have a conversation at the end of the season, depending on who wins Bundesliga, who had the weirder European move between Zaha and Pom
Again.
again?
Yeah.
Like, that is crazy.
Kane wins the game. Kane breaks the record again, 27 and 23. It's a shorter league, so he's only got about 10, 12 games left. If he hits 41, 42, that's
Yeah,
and
that's
doesn't
true.
win the league, it's but yeah, it's such a mixed, a confusing season for him.
He's definitely had the better season, but yeah, it's gonna be, yeah.
Yeah. So we came to Germany and we're just talking about one striker there. I want to drop down a league to talk about another striker. Not too far down. They're at the top of the Bundesliga 2. St. Pauli. Do you know a lot about St. Pauli, Scully? Are you aware of St. Pauli?
I do not know anything about St. Pauli.
They are the most outwardly left-wing club, certainly in terms of like ultras culture, that I can think of. And the fan base is known to be absolutely like crazy, but very welcoming. Just under the Bundesliga is their level. They're not really big enough to be a Bundesliga side, but they're quite well known, quite popular. They are top of the league though. 6 points clear after a 4-3 win. Shout out to English players abroad for bringing my attention to this one. The score of two goals in that 4-3 win was Darpo Afolyan, who is 26 years old, born in Harrow. They signed him from Bolton for about £500,000 back in the summer. His career is fascinating to me and I absolutely love it. In the Chelsea Academy as a kid, then does.
Shock surprise, by the way.
Yep. Isn't it always the case? Then pivots to the Toronto FC Academy, is there for what looks like 2 years, then comes back to England and is in the Barnet Academy, and then drops down to Tooting & Mitcham, by the looks of it. Then goes back to Canada for college. And I mean, we had Brendan Mohammed on in the first season as an example of football as a vehicle in the States, and it looks like Canada as well. I mean, Toronto are an MLS side. It's a vehicle to play football at a decent level while also getting an education and a scholarship or something out of it. Then comes back here, does a year at Loughborough, then plays for Solihull Moors. Like 1 in 3 for Solihull Moors. That's like a National League North side. That's enough to get a move to West Ham United 5 years ago. He didn't end up playing for West Ham. He was sort of loan spells in the lower leagues, Oldham, Mansfield, and then Bolton, where he eventually signs on a permanent and then finds his way to St. Pauli. I mean, there's enough there for us to chat to him. Someone not afraid to travel, but also someone that's used football as a vehicle to learn, and then is playing at one of the most fun clubs in Europe and could be in the Bundesliga next season.
I'm hoping he travels up. Like, you never know how long it will take or when he'll get there. For example, Chuba Akpom, who we've spoken about a lot, who knows where he'll go next after this time here, and he's 27 years old now, so big up Dapo. I hope it's a good time. They got another player at St. Pauli, I can see. One of yours.
Yeah, Scott Banks. He's a Scottish kid, was playing sort of Scottish Championship, I think. Palace signed him, had a good year at Bradford last season. They loaned him to St. Pauli this year, and it was like all set up to be really exciting. And then I think on his third appearance, he does his ACL and he hasn't played since. He did an interview about it
Big
recently,
shame.
quite frustrated. Like he's still there. I think because there's hope that he might return before the end of the season, he's still there. Which I think is, I don't know whose call that is, but I think that's really interesting because you could imagine him in a strop just going, oh my God, I've been here 6 weeks and I've done my ACL. I just want to go home. Like, let me go home and do my physio. Let me, or go to Palace where and just ride out my recovery. But whoever's decision it was, he stayed there and may yet make an impact towards at the end of the season. That'd be a story.
Get some promotion. That would be lovely for them.
Yeah. I want to thank Cam, English Players Abroad, again for this next one because it's a bit rogue. Lithuania, not a country we're going to go to too often. They're in their pre-season. Their season runs from March to November. Their curtain raiser is the Lithuanian Super Cup. It's like our community shield. And the league title holders, a team called Panevesic, I believe, they won the Super Cup. And there's a guy playing for them who is involved in that game called Noel Mbeumo. Born in Congo, moved to England and came up through the Gillingham Academy, played one game for them, had a couple of non-league loans, but has also then from Gillingham, having played a couple games for Kingstonian, got moved to Helsingborg in Sweden, who are like not the climes that they once were, but like that's like a well-known established Swedish club, like have won leagues, have played in European competitions. then got a move to Lithuania from there. Panevesic are now his second Lithuanian club. He's been in the country for two seasons.
That's mad. League One all the way to Lithuanian League. That is...
Yeah, and he's involved and he's winning silverware and he's scoring goals. There's somewhere out there for you. If you want to do it, there is somewhere out there for you and you can have a great time.
Nombo, welcome to the family.
Yes, yeah.
We now have the spotlight on you.
Yes, you now have our attention. I've got a couple more things before we get into the guest. This is management stuff. Chris Coleman, first of all, linked with the Ireland job. Former Wales manager, of course, has managed abroad before. Real Sociedad, spell there, also managed in Greece. But I want to talk about that, you know, that's the opening act for the headliner. That is Steve Bruce.
Brucey.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, everyone in between, Steve Bruce wants to get back into management, according to the Daily Mirror.
I know you're excited about that.
Yeah. Been out of work about 18 months since leaving West Brom. The Mirror reports that he's been linked with various Saudi Pro League clubs. There have been offers coming from Saudi Arabia. But his preference, no word of an offer, but his preference put out there, according to sources, quote unquote, and friends say, Steve Bruce wants the South Korea job. Yes, Steve, that's what we want to see.
What? Why do you think?
I don't know. I guess I don't know how he is. He's got to be in his 60s now, right? He's been around a long time. He's managed in the Premier League at several clubs. He's probably hit his ceiling as to who he could manage at Premier League. I don't know who would actually take him on now. What's left for Steve Bruce to achieve? Has never gone abroad, never managed or played abroad. So if he's thinking, I fancy a bit of that. And maybe, South Korea underperformed at the Asia Cup. They got eliminated by Jordan.
There is some talent there.
There is, it's a decent side. They sacked Jürgen Klinsmann recently because he essentially did that job remotely for the most part, and they really didn't like
that.
That's
insane.
Yeah. It was like a running kind of joke. He's done it at other jobs as well. So they were warned. But Steve Bruce is going, that's the kind of job I want. Seeding it out through newspapers, which I find very interesting. There's not a mention that they've got bitten back and gone, here's an offer, Steve. Do you want to chat? Sit down and have a chat, maybe. All it is the news getting us excited that he's up for it. And that's enough for me to mention it.
I respect him only for shooting at this job, knowing that the barrier for entry on this job probably isn't necessarily as high as I think it should be. And I'm saying that because, like, they've got good players, really good players. So if you get in there, like, a competent coach could probably make them one of the best teams in Asia.
Yeah.
But like we're also saying, probably not a lot of managers here in the West are lining up and thinking, I want to go to South Korea. So he's kind of playing 3D chess. Like, it's actually a really, really good shout. I reckon you could get a competent manager can get South Korea to the World Cup. A competent manager could take them far in the Asian Cup. Like, you can build quite a good legacy there if you do your job well enough, based off the talent they have.
It's impossible for them to not qualify for the World Cup, really. Steve Bruce on the touchline in Mexico, leading out South Korea. That's insane. He'll be in shorts and really sunburnt and having an absolute ball. If he needs to go there to have an interview, if they does get his time to sit down with him, he can stay on a Jesse Lingard sofa. Do you know what I mean? this is great stuff. This could be the last time we hear about this, but I just thought the story couldn't not be mentioned.
Like, I want to believe that Steve Bruce believes he has the chops. Like I said, looking at that South Korea team, that I'm good enough that I can make them win things.
Yeah, he fancied himself to win an Asia Cup for sure. I imagine if he got out of the group stages of the World Cup, he would be having a good time.
Yes, good luck to him. I think it's very good that he's sanding out all the PR links now. Yeah, would they have me? Mm-hmm. He needs Jesse to go over there, be amazing, and put a good word in.
Should we get into the guest?
Let's do it.
His name is Matt Riley. He lived in Thailand for a number of years and worked his way into working in Thai football and a couple of clubs. He's written a book about his adventures, and we thought, let's get him on to talk about his experiences and, you know, answer some of our questions about Thai football, because Well, the whole point of the podcast is that we ask because we want to know more about these places and how football is in other places, because we don't know and we want to know.
Yeah, this guest was full of madcap stories. A lot was going on. I would love to experience some of the stuff he experienced. Definitely one of our most random interviews, and I mean that in the full sense of the word.
Yeah. So here we are. This is the International Clearance Chat with Matt Riley. Matt Riley, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Really well, thanks, guys. I really enjoyed your last podcast as well. You know, I've been thinking about it a lot when you talked about Archie Brown, you know, the Ghent defender.
Yeah.
And you were saying about how these players, if they're young players, just jump and see what happens, you know, sort of like jump and a parachute will appear. Really good that you're kind of supporting these kind of people, because it's a risk, isn't it?
Yeah. We're champions of adventure. That's really why we wanted to speak with you, and when the fact you spent quite a number of years out in Thailand and eventually making your way into the league over there. How many years in total was it that you were out in Thailand?
Living? So we were out in Thailand for 16 years. It was a hard place to leave. When I was working in Thai football for six of those years. So for 10 years, I was properly paid in a normal job, and 6 years, I was financially ruined, but extremely happy.
What gave you that itch to get involved?
Well, really, what happened was, unfortunately, my mum died very, very rapidly. She died of cancer, and she always wanted to be a creative soul, and she never, ever had the chance. And so I had a good job. I was head of marketing for a group of schools, and life was good. You know, kids were looked after, and obviously living in Thailand. And I just thought, she never got to follow her passion, so I want to follow mine. And I decided then, luckily supported by my wife, Karen, my main sponsor, my only sponsor, that I just jump in. And I just had this idea, like a niche idea, like, you know, in some ways you guys are niches, but I was a tiny niche, you know, Thai football in English. I've been looking at Sam from Far Corner Football, who does all the Asian stuff as well. I know you're sort of familiar with his work, but I just thought, let's go to kind of micro niche. And I really, you know, enjoyed it, but it just didn't pay the bills for a couple of years. But the experiences, lads, were just amazing. Amazing.
Have to give a big thank you to Karen for believing in your dream.
Yes.
That is, what was that conversation like?
It was really tough, because I just said to her, I want to do this, and I planned to do it. And I kind of dipped my toes in the water, to be honest, Scully. I'd worked with a local Thai football team, and I had kind of one foot in the office and one foot out of it. So one of my friends was the coach of the biggest team at the time, called Mung Tong United. So I kind of sneakily arranged for them to do the pre-match hotel around the corner from work. And then I would be at a meeting, and I would go and have breakfast with them. They slept in the morning before the games and so on. And so I was kind of preparing the ground. And because I was head of marketing, I used football for marketing and then tried to make connections. And it kind of worked quite well. But again, getting paid was extremely challenging, but Karen always believed in me, and I'm very, very lucky, because I gave up an awful lot. And, you know, first 2 years I just couldn't get arrested. You're getting no income, so everything you do, you meet a player or a coach, you've got all of it is costs, of course, and without any profits. But again, I wouldn't, on reflection, I just wouldn't swap it for anything, lads. I really wouldn't.
The niche that you speak of, the English language media in Thai football, what was the kind of pitch that got you on side with people inside clubs or in the football system that made them believe what you could see?
I was really lucky that there was a Belgian guy called Robert Prokura, an investor in Mung Tong, and was in the management of Mung Tong. And he realized there was an opportunity. Then another Belgian friend of mine, Rene, became the head coach. And that gave me the opportunity, because everything else was really patchy, apart from kind of Anglophiles. So the people that own Thai football clubs are in an interesting group of people, but some of them have been educated in the UK, like the second job I had. In fact, the shirt I'm wearing now, Supanbury FC,
very nice.
He went to school in England. And so he was much more open to the idea. A guy called Pawin Biron Bhakdi, whose family-owned Singer Beer, you know, he went to university in Boston. But I never got the momentum consistently, you know. This really weird thing, lads, where people would say, why would we use English? And you think, that's really hard to answer, because you've asked the most ridiculous question. It's a quite popular language around the world. We'd like to promote it to a larger audience. So, yeah, it was very patchy, but I had kind of probably about four or five people that were very, very supportive. And I went from talking about Thai football in general to being, I have to be honest, a bit of a mouthpiece for the two clubs. But they paid me, you know, and at the end of the day, I had to repay my major sponsor, and she eventually got repaid, sort of.
Yeah, that's it's a very interesting journey. Part of self-belief, really. Like, you have this idea and I'm going to follow through with it.
And self-delusion in a way, Scully. You know, there's so many times because I got in so far, there's always this thought of a little bit like a gambler, you know, if I stop now, maybe tomorrow something would happen. And you had to have this self-belief when you go into to Bangkok, you know, they turn up late for you or they look at you like you're a madman. And you have to keep saying, I believe in myself. And to be honest, there were times, Scully, that I kind of started to think I was a madman myself, you know. We nearly got sponsored by AIA, but the CEO was kicked out. We nearly got money from Singer, but that didn't happen. And, you know, it really does challenge you, Scully, because unless you have complete belief, then you just pack up and think, well, just get a normal job, you know, that pays the bills. But I'm glad I stuck at it. And by the time we left, actually, I was in a really good position. But for family reasons, we decided to come back. But yeah, self-belief is really, really key, Scully.
Very important lesson there for everybody listening.
Yes, be careful about the financial side of it, but do go with your dream, you know, because the memories, I wouldn't trade for anything, you know, the meeting Brian Robson and Man United, meeting Chelsea, being interviewing these sort of massive political figures that are now back in the country. You know, Thaksin Shinawatra was let out of prison last week, miraculously, so he can control the country again. What an amazing coincidence. And the guy called Nevin Chitchop that I interviewed, who's an incredibly powerful guy. And you just look back on it and think, well, it's amazing. Because after a while, lads, what happened was I became almost invisible. Once I gained their trust, I was seeing things. And I'll be honest with you, lads, there's a few things I didn't put in the book. there were things that I'd look at and think, you must know I'm in the room. You know, kilos of cash would come in. I mean, kilos and kilos of it. You'd think, and I'd say to them, you'd want me to leave. But by the time they trusted me, you know, and Thai society is massive on that. Once they trusted you, then that was it. You know, there was no question. And of course, they knew what would happen if I'd said anything.
Politics and big business as well. They both come up already in this chat. And I feel like that was a thread in the book that, you know, using your book as an introduction to Thai football, it's perhaps way more pronounced than it might be, let's say, you know, using English football as a comparison. Could you just elaborate on some to some extent how deep those ties in with the game there go?
Yeah, ties in with the ties. I mean, we can go right back to when Thaksin Shinawatra bought Manchester City, because what was happening was with the Thai politics is just ridiculous. You know, the last election this year, or just at the end of last year, they refused to accept the result of a democratic election, basically waiting for Thaksin to come back. And now he essentially will be the prime minister with control. But once they started to get banned, so Thaksin was banned from politics. Now, when Chitchat was banned from politics, my boss at Sapanbury was banned from politics. I think it's actually quite a clever idea, lads, because what they did was they had these oceans and oceans of money like you would not believe, and they wanted to control their provinces. And Top, my boss, he was very open about it, and he said, look, Matt, I'm not in politics. Well, he's back in it now. He's in the Thai cabinet, but I'm not in politics, but I know that if I put all this money into the football club, I've got their vote, but I'm technically not actually canvassing them. So it actually made a lot of sense, lads, and how can I phrase it? Money needed to be massaged from one state to another. And football, you know, we know it's not just in Thailand, but football was a fantastic vehicle for money that may not be as sparkly white as you'd like it to be more usable, shall we say. You know, a lot of it would be capital projects. Like in Sapanbury, you know, we imported floodlights from America. And I remember going into the office one day and saying, oh, you know, Kuntop, oh, is there a problem with the lights? And he said, no, there's no problem with the lights. These cost £700,000, Matt. And I said, yeah, but why are you buying them? He said, well, they're from America. And I just thought, okay, I'll leave it there. I know what's happening. It was certainly very interesting. But you learn an awful lot about Thai culture as well, lads. You know, it was so hard to get in. But once you got validated, all of these powerful people are in a very small group. And so particularly with Pawin Biron Bhakdi from the Singer Beer Corporation, in fact, his uncle owns Singer Beer Corporation. Once you got validated, then just suddenly things would happen. And it took, I'll be honest, 3 years. I think it probably take at least 3 years. But all those 3 years, I was being tested, you know, I was being fed things to see if I'd share it. And Thai society is, if you respect them, they'll never forget it. If you let them down, you've got to watch out for generations. But the trust will go next generation, my children, my grandchildren, they'll find a way to help you if you show that trust and keep your mouth closed most of the time.
Yeah. Which brings me to, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, is it Grengzhai?
Yes. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, the kind of very particular, unusual national etiquette. Could you teach our listeners a bit about that and how it applied and was affecting your time in football?
Yeah, absolutely. And this killed a lot of coaches. You know, I saw a lot of coaches, particularly people like Matt Elliott in Army, Gary Stevens in Taipur. So essentially what Grengzhai is, so you arranged to meet me at this time for this interview, okay? With Grengzhai, if you guys didn't turn up, I would be required to apologize to you, okay? Oh. Not you to me. I turned up, you didn't, but I apologize to you. Now, we both know that you didn't turn up and I did, and that is an accepted fact between us. And we will never mention the fact that you didn't turn up. Now, in return, you owe me something. Now, it could be a future contract. It could be access to some of your network. It could be something else. But we never, ever mention that. We never, never mention it. And this happened to Supambri when we qualified for the Asian Champions League. And because of a paperwork error, we were kicked out. All of the media was expunged. All the photos of us celebrating at the Army United Stadium, no one ever, ever mentioned it. And anyone who did, they were gone. No, it was never explained. And I always describe it as like a dance, and you're not really sure of the moves. And it took me 2 or 3 years to work that out because I really struggle with people who are late for meetings. I really struggle when people let me down. And it happened so many times, particularly in my first club, Mung Tong United. But after a while, I had to realize that I was in the wrong for being there on time and they were in the right. And it's a little bit like it's sort of showing your hierarchy in the Thai society. But it's actually quite relaxing when you know it, to be honest, lads. But at the time, mm-hmm. I really, really struggle with it because I just say to them, if you want to be Western orientated, you have to think about the fact that you can't act in this complex way. But this is really baked into all of Thai society, but particularly Thai football. And a lot of foreign players have come a cropper with this, you know, really have it. Robbie Fowler really struggled when he came over to Mung Tong because they just don't get it, you know. And it's partly to do with losing face as well. Personal space, you know, you get a lot of players, you know, Peter Withe was essentially sacked for politics because he was a very aggressive, in a good way, coach. They couldn't deal with that. So, yeah, it's a funny thing, Grengzhai, guys. I tell you what, it's very, very odd, but again, sort of freeing. You know, if I'm apologizing to you for something you've done wrong, we kind of both can relax after that if we're in the right mentality.
Is there a part of that where that debt is paid, if you like, that you actually start to see the full picture of this and why it still happens?
Oh, definitely, definitely. So I wanted to interview a guy called Nick or Chutanam Baron Bagdi. Okay, so he was the CEO of Singer. Yeah. And it took me about 2 years to get to him. And I knew that there was about 7, 8, 9 steps that I had to make by essentially buying and selling credit on the respect ladder, if you like. And I realized that's the way that it was done. I ended up going to his office. He's running the Singer Beer Corporation. End up there for like an hour and a half with a friend of mine taking photos because I passed all those tests. And you only have to fail one, lads, and you're back to zero. You know, right. It is astonishing, but it there is a lot of this, almost like a barter system, if you like. But again, you never mention it. I never said to Nick, oh, thank you, your cousin helped me. Because then what I'm doing is I'm kind of exposing the going under the bonnet of the whole system. But oh man, I tell you, it was so hard because my wife worked at a school, an English school over there, and they did things so differently. But I come back from work and I kind of tell her what happened and then try and explain what that meant. And it wasn't what it seemed to me. It was very strange. But again, it ultimately was very freeing.
It's an interesting one because I think there is a lot to social customs, right? Like I think when you explain anyone's social customs to some people, they might not make sense at the time. But when you look into it, it does make sense. And even as you break it down, the concept of Grengzhai, like I don't think it's actually that dissimilar to some office cultures we have now, right? Like you never actually, there's certain things that when you work in an office, you don't ever acknowledge it head on. It's just accepted and you know what that means.
Definitely, Scotty, and it's kind of connected to the families out there because the families are so tightly bound and so well connected. And a lot of these massive businesses, like the Singer Corporation, they are passed down through the family. So you know, it all intersects the family, like now in Chit Chop. He's got this unbelievable stadium, which is exactly the same as King Power Stadium. Mm-hmm. And I actually went there with Sven-Göran Eriksson when he was coaching a team called BC Terro. And he said even the toilets are exactly the same place. He said it was really odd sensation. But he has this, he actually owns, Neven Čiča owns part of Leicester through 7-Eleven, through this thing called Central Processing Foods. And all of these things, all of this power, all of this influence is all connected to the way that business is done and the way families are run and the way families interconnect. And again, I think there's an awful lot to learn there, because I think one of the key things for me, guys, with the book is, and I started off, you know, a love letter to Thai football. I kind of wouldn't change anything. It's weird because it's corrupt. Yes. Things I saw and heard about referees and, oh, it's unbelievable. But I kind of wouldn't change it. It is a beautiful madness. You know, it was just incredible to see.
So clearly there were a lot of people in Thailand that felt the same way as you there, who still embraced the game in with as much enthusiasm and match day joy and sparkle as we would. And what else was there that made you fall in love with the game as they did?
For me, it was this kind of beautiful carnival atmosphere. You know, we had a situation where the away fans would have to go through the home fans in the early days, because at Mung Tong we only had one stand to start with, and the grannies were being wired to, were being clapped by the opposition or our home fans. And this wonderful full-day carnival, the pride, I think the other thing is this feeling of regional pride, because a lot of regions like Buriram, before the billions that Neven Čiča, let me say, earned from the government, they were so impoverished and forgotten. And it gives you a chance to celebrate them. Because in the early days of Thai football, it was Thai tobacco monopoly, Bangkok Bank. It was the Port Authority. How do you cheer those people? So it's actually not as popular as it was when I was working there before. But there is this great idea of also, you know, the idea is you used to get paid. You used to get paid to be a fan. Well, when I was at Mung Tong, we had what we called a happy bus. Now, you imagine Bangkok to Buriram is about 7 hours. You had free transport and free beer. So you get to the game and then you're on your way home and you can't remember what the score was. You can't remember if you were there. There's this beer called Leo, and there would be crates and crates of it. And this whiskey called Sang Som. And another great thing about it is I only once saw a riot, and that was politically motivated between Thai Port and Mung Tong, who were from the other side, the two sides of that. So for me, it was just this wonderful carnival atmosphere. You get multiple generations, all kinds of different people that may be socially and not normally having groups. And then you just literally get intoxicated in all kinds of ways for the game. And it was difficult when I started working at the football, because, of course, you had to lay off the beers because you had a report to write or an interview to give, something afterwards. But you still felt that feeling of intoxication, which is fantastic. I really look back on it with great, great memories.
Happy bus probably wouldn't work in British culture. I just can't see
it. Oh, yeah, but it's probably not happy all the time, to be honest.
No,
yeah,
that's the trouble.
There was never trouble. It's kind of self-policing as well. If there was anyone that started, we had this little guy called Noi, which actually means small, and he can get a little bit funny when he was drunk. So people would just carry him off in the stadium and they put him under the bar to sleep, you know, and there's it's a little bit like an old English pub, you know, when you've got layers of protection, if you like, the way that things are done.
What was the high mark for you in your time working in Thai football?
For me, it was when I was working on Fox Sports Central, and that really helped my profile. So it was a daily magazine show on Fox Sport, and I was pretty much the only person who could talk about Thai football in English. And so that gave me an awful lot of momentum with people. So I'd be on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, and then on the weekend, other coaches would see me, other players had seen me, and this really, really helped. So that was a great feeling. That was also a low point, because Paul Parker was supposed to be on before me, and he turned up late, and they rewired or they'd done something wrong. So I was on Fox Sport and all I could hear was the people in the editing booth. I couldn't hear the guy who was talking to me. Essentially, you know, I'm guessing what he says. So he could be saying to me, what do you think about the game tomorrow? And I'll say, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's green. It's definitely green. And I look back on that and I think, oh my goodness. Because I didn't have time to say this to them, you know, I cannot hear a word the guy's saying. So Fox Sport was a really, really helpful thing for me. Took an awful long time, like most things, to organise through people like a guy called Steve Darby and when Brian Robson was there. But that really was great. And the qualification for the Champions League until we got kicked out 3 or 4 weeks later.
You've touched on a few names, and there's a few that you wanted to kind of highlight, especially players, coaches that have also been in Thai football from the UK. Some more positive experiences than others. Who do you think, given what we've spoken about, the unusual etiquette and just a different approach to football over there, who do you think took it on best out of some of those bigger names?
Yeah, for me, it maybe wasn't a massive name, but Zesh Rehman. Zesh was the first Asian player to play in the English Premier League. Zesh was great because even when he came, he'd set up a foundation. He'd done a lot of work with that foundation. He tapped into what the etiquette was. And obviously, he's from Pakistani, so he's sort of South Asian, if you like, heritage. And he was really good. He was a very good player as well, even then. They kicked him out at Mung Tong because they didn't know what to do with him. But Zesh was great. He used to come to my kids' school to promote the idea of inclusivity. And he really took on. And he always felt like he had a plan. You know, he left Mung Tong and went off to go and work in Hong Kong, amongst other places. So he was a really good example of accept the culture, make the most of the culture. And when you leave, just have a plan, an exit strategy, if you like, which a lot of foreign players didn't have. They thought they could change the system. They were wrong. Zesh knew that you just can't. You have to live with what the limitations that you've been given.
Am I right in thinking Robbie Fowler's there at the same time, or at least, or do they cross paths at Mung Tong?
Yeah, they did. They played together a few times. Yeah, Robbie was definitely an interesting one. He struggled a little bit in Australia, and the football director called Mr. Pei, who's still there actually. Robbie had a lot of injuries, and I was there when he was getting his medical for Mung Tong. And he was very open about them. You know, he'd say he's talked about all his injuries, but Mr. Pei was so determined to sign him up that he just let him play. And Robbie was way, way past his sell-by date. You know, he'd come from Perth Glory the year before. He played for, I think it's Queensland Fury as well. But he ended up only playing 13 games. And the funny thing was that he actually, Mung Tong trained at my kid's school because they had a really good field. And this was me, part of my fishing expedition get a job in Thai football.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had a guy called Henry Calisto as a coach, who was a fantastic coach, but he was hard man. You know, he was a little bit like Slavisa Djukanovic, who, as you know, was also there for a year. But there was an argument between Robbie and Calisto because Robbie was carrying a lot of timber. And I was just saying to my kids, because the kids were younger there, I said, oh, that's Robbie Fowler. You know, go and get his autograph. And as soon as they walked up to him, they were literally nose to nose. And then the next day, the coach was sacked and suddenly Robbie was the player coach. And you realize then that it was all about what Robbie could bring to the club. And it didn't end well. I read his autobiography, actually, and he said they did well to come third. But it's a little bit like Celtic saying they came third and it was a great season, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it sold well. I mean, he was saying about how Mr. Pei knew so much about football. And I was thinking, Robbie, I know that guy. He knows very little. But you've got to spin it, haven't you? That's what it's about. But yeah, Robbie really struggled because his family weren't there. There was a hotel just next to the stadium. Robbie spent a lot of time just kind of kicking his heels in the room. He struggled again with his weight. He had a hip injury. He had a couple of other injuries. And it never really took off. And also the whole idea of the formation was you had to give the ball to Robbie because they were basically trying to get, you know, videos of him scoring goals. So it completely unbalanced the team because essentially there was only one tactic. And the other clubs realized what was going on, put a player on Robbie. And that was the end of it, you know. And for Mung Tong to come third in those days was, you know, was a little bit like Man City avoiding relegation on the final day.
You talked about Brian Robson. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, Brian was gone really well with Brian. Basically, Brian had a lot of problems with the politics of Thai football. And his assistant, Steve Darby, who's a really nice guy, really supportive. I offered for Brian to the national team to come to my kid's school. And they had unbelievable facilities. It's just incredible. I mean, astonishing. And to close the whole school off so that only Brian and the players could be there. None of the press could get to them because Brian was getting an awful lot of grief from the press and the politics around Thai football, because the oversight of Thai football, lads, is an absolute joke. You know, Manopol King, the last coach, has been basically sacked on purpose because he was too good and they didn't like that fact. So got to know Brian and his wife, really nice guy. He very kindly did a few things for the school, met the kids. I found the Man United fans and we had some lunches together. But it was a strange existence for Brian because there was a Man United bar in Bangkok as well. And people were getting paid to get him there and, I'll be honest, to get him drunk. And when Brian, you may have seen that secretly filmed documentary when Brian had been plied with beer about buying football clubs. And if you look back on that video, it's interesting because it's nearly all of those clubs are now owned by Asian people. But he was really supportive. And when Man United came, I had a fantastic experience in the Man United hotel. He very kindly invited me in. And I remember the Man United players were very, very kind of negative about us being there. And he just shouted across the hotel and said, "Matt, sorry, I'm late." And suddenly all the Man United players were thinking, "My goodness, who's this?" And all the Man United groupies, you know, that was another thing, lads. When I went into the, I think it was the Four Seasons in Bangkok, there's so many male groupies as well. That's another slightly disturbing thing. But they were desperate. And to start with, they were very aggressive. So to give you an idea, there was probably about 2,000 people outside. I was lucky that my friend Scott Cooper was the coach of Buriram at the time, and they were winning everything, and that got us in. And then you've got those kind of Uber groupies, if you like. And then there was the chairs right next to reception where the Man United players were. Now, we sat there and there was a real feeling of resentment from those Uber groupies. But as soon as Brian came down, suddenly they're passing me things. They want Brian to sign and all this kind of thing. And I have to say, I thought it's a strange existence that Brian had, because he was kind of a currency for other people. Do you know what I mean? There was one night where he was at the Man United bar. I was there with my wife, Karen. And I just thought, I'm not going to bother him. And I just walked by and I said, "Oh, Brian, lovely to see you. You know, not really nice." And he sort of snapped at me. He said, "Oh, what do you want?" And he didn't recognize who I was, whatever. And I just thought, "That's no problem. I'll leave him," because he'd probably been had loads of people. And then he came back over to Karen and I and he said, "Oh, look, I'm really sorry. But normally people are always hassling me for things they're going to sell online, or, you know, my autograph or a photo." And again, I always got that feeling of, I don't think he was particularly happy. You know, he had that great passion to be a coach, and for one reason or another, it just didn't work in Thailand. And, you know, it's really a real shame. But it was fantastic to meet, you know, to meet him. And probably not being a Man United fan helped me as well. So I could just get to know him and not be in awe of what he did.
It's probably nice to just be around somebody who just respects you for your work.
Yeah, and I hope he's happy to know he did. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I hope he knows he did, because I'd actually arranged to meet him in the Shangri-La Hotel. And I remember thinking at the time, I was getting no money coming in, and I had this coffee, and I looked at it, I thought, "My goodness, how expensive is that?" And he didn't turn up. And I just thought, "Oh, I've just been done again." And he remembered that, and inviting me to the Man United Hotel was his way of saying sorry for what he'd done. And he didn't have to do that. You know, I was completely a nobody in football, but that spoke a lot to his character, and I was very impressed with that. And again, I think he knew that I just basically liked him for who he was, and I wanted to help him, particularly with the situation of the politics of the Thai FA, because, you know, they are absolutely, they're suicidal for Thai football. They always were, and they probably always will be, lads. And it don't make any sense at all.
In what sense was the most frustrating part of how they manoeuvred?
For us, it was the fact that if someone is successful, they're a threat. If they're successful, particularly and foreign, you know, for example, Peter Withe was technically fired for wearing shorts on the touchline in, what, 38 degrees? But basically he was sacked because he was successful and he changed the style of play. He had managed to find a big Thai centre forward, which is not easy, and he was doing very, very well. So I don't want to sound overly cynical, but they fear success, because with success comes a need for oversight and scrutiny. You know, there was a guy, Warui Makudi, who was an absolute, I mean, you shake his hands and, you know, his hand and you count your fingers afterwards. He didn't want to come on out from under the rocks because he was getting money to vote for England in the World Cup and then not vote for England. He was getting paid from both sides. And my former president for this club, Top, he used to be the prime minister, and they used to call him Mr. ATM. If you need money, I don't care if you're with me or against me. Just give me money and we'll all be fine. And I'll agree to disagree. I mean, what he did for the England bid was so unbelievably shocking. But then the English FA were going to bring England over. So we're not pure either. You know, if it wasn't for the parliamentary privilege that was used to actually expose Warui, he'd probably still be there now. And it's a really weird thing, though, guys, because, you know, to be scared of success is a very odd way to run any organisation, particularly a football one.
Yeah. Polar opposite of the blind ambition of football, some football league clubs, Premier League clubs. Really odd way of doing things. So, yeah, I guess to close then, if somebody, whether it's doing media duties as yourself did, or whether it's going there to play in Thailand or manage in Thailand, what is your kind of recipe for success? What would be the best way to get on the right path, at least, anyway?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is to do your homework before you get there. I think once you've made one mistake, you're gone. is to be really cognizant of things like, even things like this idea of personal space. Be very aware that raising your voice to a tie is incredibly disrespectful. This thing about the feet and the head, that doesn't really matter in Thai football or Thai society now. But do your homework before you come. It always err on the side of caution. You know, realize that the guy that owns your club there, for example, they had this really weird thing when I was there. If you are a middle-ranking manager, you'll get a speech before the game. If you're bigger than him, you have to have a longer speech. Not better, just longer. If you're the absolute boss, you have to have the longest speech of all. So when I first started in Thai football, 7:30 kickoff would be 7:35, 7:40, 7:45. And you have to accept that as what you've bought into, because, you know, the money is decent, very decent to some of these clubs, and they'll pay in cash. When we won at Suphanburi, everyone was rewarded down to the coach driver. And all, again, all of it was cash. So it was, let's say, tax friendly for the players. So do your homework, err on the side of caution. And then again, you'll love it. You know, you'll absolutely love it. And that some people of the very first players, they really did enjoy their time there. It's particularly those, of course, that were half Thai and half English, because they already knew the culture there. But yeah, do your homework. Don't think you can change them, because I was there 16 years and I changed zip. Again, I would recommend it, though. I definitely recommend it. There's a lot of people who go out there and have amazing times. If you can cope with the heat and you can cope with the culture, and it is a beautiful culture. You know, we had 2-year contracts and we kept signing again. And if it wasn't for family, we'd probably be still there, lads. I'd be talking to you 6 hours ahead in Thailand.
Well, if anybody listening wants to know more, go and get the book, Thai Football Tales, A Beautiful Madness. Thank you for your time once again.
Good stuff. Our pleasure. Thanks a lot, guys.
That book again, Thai Football Tales, A Beautiful Madness. We've only touched on some of the experiences that Matt did. We didn't want to spoil the entire book for you in the chat. Otherwise, that defeats the purpose of his visit. But
please contact us at intlclearance@gmail.com. That is intlclearance@gmail.com. You can find us on all the social medias at intlclearance. Yeah.
We'll be back next week. And thank you, Scully.
Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.